The XX GabFest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, April 3rd, the Conscious Uncoupling Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen in the D.C. studio. I'm joined in New York by June Thomas, writer and editor for Slate, especially of the Outward blog. Hi, June.
Hello, Hannah.
And also Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi.
Before we begin, Noreen, I binge-watched Broad City, thanks to you. It's totally funny. I mean, it's like really, really funny. Like, their characters are, you're totally right. It has such a particular vibe to it, and I really liked it.
They're amazing. Have you watched the latest episode?
No, I didn't watch the latest one. I'm not quite that far. I mean, they're just like, they're not lovable or anything, but they're just like hilariously ridiculous.
But they love
ridiculous.
Each other. They love each other, which is heartwarming.
Yeah.
The last episode of the season, I think, is like an absolute masterpiece. I like was shaking in my room laughing at it.
So, oh, really? Okay, good. I'll keep going then. We got a bunch of letters into our new email address, and I'm really pleased about that. Most of them were about the story I wrote in The Atlantic, The Overprotected Kid, which we discussed on our last podcast. And they said a similar thing. I'm going to read from Pam Allen, who moved to a mill town in rural New England, which she describes as a mix of the barely working and the unemployed, undocumented farm workers scraping by, young people who need cheap rent. And she says, in good weather, the neighborhoods are filled with kids riding bikes and skateboards with no helmets. And children play up and down the streets with no adults watching over them. So I have to wonder if this overprotectiveness is still a matter of class. And a similar email came in from Lily Allen, who teaches at an after-school program in the Bronx. And she says there are many, many roving packs of unsupervised kids, but they're not white suburban kids. So I think we get the message here that maybe the overprotected kid is an upper or elite or at least white or middle class phenomenon. Point taken.
Hey, Hannah, what is that email address?
Good question.
You're so good at this.
It is XXGabFest@slate.com. XXGabFest@slate.com. And we've been responding to those emails, so please keep them coming. Okay, our three topics for this week. First, do people in happy marriages have affairs? The answer, tragically, is yes, and we will find out why. Second, Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin are getting divorced. Did I say divorce?
You did.
I mean they're getting a conscious uncoupling. What the hell does that mean? And third, lady chefs, can women make it in the obnoxiously macho world of celebrity chefs? And Jesus, can we have the kitchen back? Okay. Let's start with the happy marriages. It is comforting to think that affairs are the refuge of the unhappily married, but that is, of course, not true. Last week, I did a Q&A in Slate with the woman who the New York Times calls the nation's sex therapist. Her name is Esther Perel. She's a therapist in New York. And she is, I suppose, our updated Dr. Ruth. Perel argues that our cozy marriages these days are a little too cozy and close. We insist on knowing everything about each other, and that becomes stifling, such that we lose ourselves and stray outside marriage to seek not another person necessarily, but another version of ourselves. And here is the – I'm going to read you guys the sentence that most people sent back to me in emails, which is this sentence of Esther Perel's from the Q&A. It isn't so much that we want to leave the person we are with as we want to leave the person we have become. That seems to really strike a chord with a lot of our readers who sent that back to me. Did that resonate with either of you?
It certainly did in terms of the tone. I mean, what I've never spoken to Esther Perel, so I've only experienced her through interviews like yours or others that have appeared in like Salon and The New Yorker even. And it's very interesting, especially since we're going to be talking about Gwyneth, that she does seem to both talk in very new age therapist speak, but also not be annoying. Like, she seems kind of inspiring and stimulating instead of annoying and
insipid.
So in that sense, yeah, it does seem kind of, yeah, well, why not? But that's when you really question it, it kind of feels like, sorry, what is that saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think the line with these interviews is that between sort of annoying and inspiring is that she comes from a very, European cosmopolitan. It's very much Psy, you Americans, you know, all the things that you Americans don't understand. She happens to be, she grew up in Antwerp. She speaks Hebrew. She speaks French. She speaks like 9 languages total. And she has that air about her, mm-hmm. you know, where you can't quite pin down exactly where she's from. She spoke to me in Hebrew. She spoke to her sons who walked into the house in French. You know, it's like one of those situations. Mm-hmm. So she really has a kind of outside perspective on the American prudery or the American view of things. I first came across her actually because I was talking about the Underwood marriage in House of Cards. I called her to talk about that and whether she thought the Underwood marriage was a great example of a marriage or not. I wanted to get her opinion about that.
What did she think?
She thought, yes. I mean, what she said is that Americans misunderstand them as a power couple, that they think of them as sort of expedient, having no true love or connection between them, but just being together for utilitarian reasons because they could push each other's career forward, but they actually had no great relationship themselves. Where she thinks it's the opposite. She thinks they have a just superb form of intimacy. Mm-hmm. And the key element for her in a superb form of intimacy is differentiation. That's what she thinks that marriages don't have today, and that's what she admires in their marriage. The idea that we respect each other's ability to be separate human beings. That's just one element. That's not the only thing she says, but she thinks that's very important, and that's what these sort of companionate, close, you know, really, really close marriages that we have these days don't quite allow for.
Yeah, that was in the piece and also what you're saying, what struck a chord most with me. I'm not married. Most of my friends are not married, but people are starting to talk about it. And I had a pretty serious conversation with a friend who's probably going to marry his girlfriend. And he said, you know, she's great. I realized at some point, as much as she is wonderful, she's not going to fill every role in my life. That's why you have other friends and whatever. And a lot of people don't realize that, I think, and then maybe wake up at some point and realize that, no, this person is not superhuman and able to magically mutate into whatever human being I need her to be, you know, at any given time. And I thought that was very mature of him. And that's also something that she says in this piece. I don't have the exact line written down, but it's something to the effect of you have to basically, your expectations have to be reasonable.
Well, it's funny, this thing that your friend takes for granted, that this person should be everything, she finds remarkable. Mm-hmm. Like, she's stepping outside that and think it's like a remarkable point in history we've come to. There's hardly another country, well maybe in other Western countries, but it's not common around the world, and it's certainly not common in history that one would think of one's spouse that way. Like, your family filled certain roles, your girlfriends or male friends filled certain roles, you know, and I guess she's implying even, like, in certain countries, like she talks about Latin America, like, your lovers would fill certain roles. Like, she says that if you were a Latin American man, the idea that you would have to justify yourself, like, say, I had an unhappy marriage and that's why I'm having an affair, is absurd. Like, everybody understands why a man in Latin America has an affair. It's not that, you know, you have to probe very deeply about that.
There's a lot of what she says that feels like, I can't tell if it really is of the moment or if it's that we just grab onto these things because it's the right kind of problem that we like to have. It's a problem of excess happiness or of excess stuff. You know, like, it's if you're going to have problems, have that kind of problem. It's very appealing. I mean, you know, all of this stuff of we're now at a time where things have changed, where, you know, all the stuff that you were just talking about the type of relationship, the fact that we live longer. You know, another thing that she said that I find very appealing is, you know, she's been married to one guy, I guess, or she certainly has been married to one guy for a long time, but she talks about having had 4 marriages with him. Like, things have changed, you know, the relationship changes at different stages, before you have kids, after kids, you know, at a certain stage of life. That's very appealing too. I have to, just to ask you about something, Hannah, in this interview.
No.
In the interview with her, as you've said at other times, you kind of express disbelief at the whole idea of the, you know, what Dan Savage calls monogamish type relationships, that those couldn't possibly work in heterosexual relationships. Do you really think that? Does it seem so crazy to you?
You know, I'm in a kind of endless loop about this because if I say it again, I'll get like 1,000 emails from the polyamorous, right. Polyamorous Association of America, which it always happens to me. Now, I had an interesting experience at Esther's house because Esther was saying this and I gave my usual disbelief, like, you know, I imagine myself walking up to my husband and having this conversation with him, and it seems, you know, comical, right? She had a research assistant who was closer to Noreen's age than mine, you know, probably mm-hmm. somewhere in between us. And she said, well, I actually did have this conversation with my husband. You know, I talked to him about this, that you know, I want to have a long marriage with him and this might come up. And what did he think about this? And so, you know, at that point, I had to shut up, like, just because I have a hard time imagining it. A, it may be generational, and B, it may not be everyone. But it may be that the more we talk about it, the more it enters people's consciousness, the more it doesn't seem so crazy. Like, Dan Savage also has this line that if you have one affair in a 50-year marriage, then you're really good at monogamy. Right. So like that it doesn't, you know, so in the American way of defining it, absolutely, we're kind of punishing ourselves. I mean, I'm not sure what I think of it. So it's kind of new to me. So I'm just trying to absorb it. I mean, Noreen, about your generation, she says something slightly different, that the younger people she sees who aren't married yet have almost the opposite problem, that they're so invested in differentiation that it's hard for them to accept intimacy as a natural state, which I thought maybe would put you at some advantage, like you'd land in the middle somewhere. But
what does that mean, that people are so good at being friends that they don't want to have sex, or the opposite?
No, it means that people are so individuated, like they are single for so many years that they don't have the same expectations that Esther says. She went into her marriage thinking, my husband's going to rescue me. You know, I'm never going to be unhappy again once I marry this man. You know, I'm never going to have a hole of loneliness in my life. That she went into it with a total expectation, but that young people today don't actually have that expectation because they're so self-reliant and so interested in kind of building themselves, their brand, their identity, their profession, that they have the opposite problem. They have a problem with merging. Merging doesn't seem as natural to them.
I think that's probably true for some people. And I think the other problem is probably true for some people. And then there are probably some people with no problems, and they are so lucky.
They are so lucky, exactly. The other broad thing she says about affairs is the idiom that we talk about them in, including therapists, that it's all about betrayal and trauma. This was another one that took me a while to get my head around. In other words, you go to a therapist's office, it's like, she has to apologize to me because she had this affair and I'm the victim of the affair. And so it's not that that isn't true or those hurt feelings aren't valid. It's just that nobody bothers to then probe, as she puts it, the plot of the affair itself and kind of why the person had the affair and sort of what's going on underneath it. It just immediately becomes a kind of sin and redemption narrative that doesn't do anybody any good, that doesn't really get at the root of the problem. Does that strike you as kind of libertine, irresponsible, or does it make sense to you?
It seems very sensible to me. I mean, it feels like there's some kind of, you know, Puritan religious aspect to this whole thing of there are many aspects to a marriage, to a relationship. There's really only one that is even in some ways legally grounds for separation, and that is if you are intimate with another person.
There's a very mature way of putting intimate with another person.
And why should that be the one thing? You know, like, why do we freak out about that so much? And it feels like it's attached to all kinds of old-fashioned ideas about maybe, you know, having children, perhaps. Like, you want to know that your husband is the father of your children or whatever, or the father wants to know that he's the father of your children. It feels very outdated. At the same time, I understand that it is also, it feels to me that this is all very kind of an orientation thing, that for some people it really is a boundary that is completely uncool. That's the one, you know, it is of that kind of higher power. But I don't see that it has to be.
Okay. It's a hard one because it's so primal and it's so visual, you know? I mean, that's the problem. And right. Sensory, like, it engages all, like, emotional affair.
Yeah.
Right. It's like emotional affairs, like, that can exist on a long continuum. What does that mean? That you have a really good friend at work? You know, it can mean all sorts of things from, you know, I have a colleague I dig to I'm in love with someone else, you know?
I don't think that being monogamish actually solves this problem always. I think it's really appealing to say, oh, we need to get past our, like, old-fashioned notions of betrayal and trauma. I recently was talking to a friend who has an open marriage, but they have specific rules around what that means. Well, I didn't know this about her until recently, and so she was telling me about it. And at first I was like, oh my gosh, this is, like, awesome and enlightened, blah, blah, blah. And as, like, the evening wore on, she started to talk about the complications of it and how betrayed she felt, like, when he didn't tell her at the right time. And then it became about, like, there were rules, but he'd broken the rules. And even though you could sleep with someone else, you had to, like, do it in the right way.
Absolutely.
And you had to tell at the right time. And so it is, I mean, that is sort of a twist on it, right? Like, you're having an open marriage. You theoretically don't mind if your partner is sleeping with someone else. But then if they do and don't tell you about it for 3 months, then you feel that same stab of betrayal and trauma. And I just think it's a pretty deeply baked human thing.
Right. Well, I think in my I'm actually by nature extremely monogamous and kind of boring. But I do know poly people who have expressed to me that for them, cheating is a worse sin, because when you are of this orientation where you have rules, which I think are more important, cheating becomes much more of a betrayal. It's like mm-hmm. it's a higher level betrayal. And so I definitely, you know, it's not a free pass. There's still cheating and betrayal still exist. That's not what polyamory or non-monogamy is about. Another thing that was very appealing about what Perel was saying was this whole thing of this is something that you can do for you. When you have to do the
meaning
whole,
have an affair.
Yeah, exactly. Like you've got so many responsibilities, so many things that, you know, you're kind of doing for someone else, essentially. This is something that's just for you, and it's pure pleasure in theory. You know,
I feel like in practice, probably not.
Exactly. But it does feel like the way that long-term marriages are, it's almost like there's a lot of talk, the way we talk about them, it's almost like we talk about a diet or a discipline where we're like, I don't do that. I don't see other people. Like, must we spend our whole lives kind of depriving ourselves of something? If that's an urge that you're having, by all means, negotiate it, be open about it, discuss it. But is it such a terrible thing? But
okay, can I jump in here?
Please.
Because I gravitate strongly in one direction or the other, and not in the monogamish direction, but more in the kind of, if I had to choose one as a place for marriage to evolve, in the kind of Underwood French privacy direction.
Right.
You know, this idea of kind of negotiating contracts, it's like an S&M. It just seems to me like the opposite of love and sort of the way these things sort of blossom and actually happen in life. It seems so damn American to me. You know, I know that for everyone else I'm a prude because I can't deal with monogamish, but it's also just like the idea of sitting down and have a contract with someone you love about someone else you might sleep with, and then writing it down, you have to sleep with them in just the right way. Like, I just not what where the that's not the space, the headspace that love exists in.
Yeah.
Whereas like in the Underwood way of doing it, there are no contracts, right? It's just kind of understood that these are two individual people, that is part of human nature to, you know, to be, as you said, to you know, have these urges at some point in your life, and then you but it's fundamentally also understood that we absolutely support each other and we are a team without it having to be written out.
How is their marriage different than monogamous? They didn't talk about their other affairs.
Not really.
And you remember?
Yes, they do. She asks in season one.
I was going to say in season one it is presented rather differently, and he gets really tweaked out when she goes off with Ben Daniels.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I share your feelings, Hannah, which is that I don't want anyone to think I'm an old-fashioned prude, but I just, if I get married, I just want it to be real simple and no one cheats and it's really old-fashioned.
All right, so listeners, why don't you weigh in on this question? Are you on the monogamish team? Where do you think marriage is evolving to monogamish, to privacy, or is it going to stay exactly as it has been in biblical times for now and forever? We would love to hear from you on that question. We are going to move on to our next topic, which is Gwyneth Paltrow's conscious uncoupling. But before we do that, we would like to thank our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. We love Audible for lots of different reasons. They offer hundreds of thousands of audiobook, any form of chatter available on the internet, and you can listen to them on any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. For XX listeners who aren't Audible members, you get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. Now, our book this week is Mating in Captivity by Esther Perel, the therapist we've been discussing. Her affair book is upcoming, but probably not for a couple of years. Mating in Captivity is her description of the modern marriage. It's a wonderful book, and she narrates herself, and she has one of those very appealing, you know, continental, where are you from kind of voices. So I think you'll enjoy listening to it, and it's not very long. It's only 8 hours, so you can listen to it on the drive from Sin City to
To Monogamy Town.
Your membership includes a free subscription to either the Times or the Wall Street Journal Audio Digest, so give it a try, audiblepodcast.com/XX. Let's move on to Gwyneth Paltrow. She and Chris Martin announced their split in a very Gwyneth way, accompanied by an essay written by two holistic doctors about conscious uncoupling. The idea is that the institution of marriage hasn't evolved along with our longer lifespans. We've just been discussing this, huh? So ending it doesn't mean your marriage wasn't successful. It just means your marriage has run its course. No need for nasty custody battles and all kinds of rancor. Instead, you need to be spiritually present and recognize that the partners in relationships are our teachers, and you need to avoid any wounds. It is accompanied by a picture of Gwyneth and Chris sitting on the grass, you know, looking very happy. So we should all have such a divorce. I'll ask you, Noreen, first, where do you stand on the Gwyneth hate-o-meter?
Well, first, I want to add two details from her conscious uncoupling that I think are important, which is that when the news broke, they were on vacation together on a tropical island on a divorce moon, as the tabloids were calling it. And the second detail is that shortly before announcing the split, they bought a home together with separate living quarters in which to raise their children. So those are just two more details of the way they have consciously uncoupled.
I think it's really interesting when people use the word home and when people use the word house, you know?
Did I say home?
You said home just because you had read it and it stuck in your house as home. Like, why didn't they buy a damn house like the rest of us?
Well, but like, I think, in this case, it was fraught with emotional meaning. So I said home, maybe.
Right.
Where do I stand on the Gwyneth hate-o-meter? I am not sure. So I am a very regular Goop reader, somewhat obsessive.
Say what Goop is in case people don't know.
Goop is the newsletter service that Gwyneth Paltrow puts out every week. And it's kind of like her own women's magazine, except it's only Gwyneth. And it's like, there's a lot about cleanses and, you know, it's like one week it's like how to live macrobiotic, like gluten-free. And then the next week it's like the best fried chicken in Memphis because I was on set there. And then it's, you know, links to a lot of very expensive clothing and, you know, the 21 best sushi places in London. It's just everything is very, very high. I mean, and I just cannot get enough. I click every week and sort of, you know, have an ongoing G-chat about it with a couple friends.
And your attitude is like horror, well, jealousy,
so
like envy.
I'm not even sure anymore. So it definitely started out as ironic. Like definitely ironic. Definitely was not a Gwyneth Paltrow fan. And then I was telling someone recently about my Goop obsession. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've been reading it every day for 3 years. Like blah, blah, blah. Or not every day, every week. And I was like, you know, it's ironic. And he was like, well, every day for 3 years, are you sure? And I had to stop and really recalibrate. And I'm just not sure anymore. I mean, I do think she's just elegant, you know? She's just elegant.
Yeah, she is.
That's all I got.
Wow, I'm just horrified, I have to say.
You are?
You. Yeah.
And me?
Your habits, yeah. No, I'm not horrified. But, you know, that whole Gwyneth vibe of, like, you know, just kind of confusing health and goodness and virtue with skinniness and, you know, selfish desire. It's that whole thing which she doesn't uncouple, forgive the phrase, which drives me crazy about her, such that she'll present things as virtuous, which are really about something else, like looking good or being cuter. And I suppose it's all mixed up there in Goop. She's not wrong about conscious uncoupling. I mean, we've just been discussing this with Esther Perel. Esther Perel, in fact, says the thing you said, June, when a couple comes in and they've, you know, they've just been destroyed and found out yesterday about an affair, the most hopeful sentence she says is the sentence about how marriages go through different phases and your first marriage is over, but you can enter your second marriage now. And that's the thing they kind of grasp onto. So there is something to this idea. But, you know, presenting in this kind of natural, biological, holistic way, you know, this is just how it's because of our lifespans. She just wants a divorce. Fine. She can have a divorce. Like, we all live in long lifespans and some of us make it through and some of us don't. And so her marriage didn't make it. I'm not moralistic about it. It's just the opposite. It's just presenting everything she does as a virtue drives me bananas.
The thing about Gwyneth, and I kind of like her, and my girlfriend loves Gwyneth, and it's so weird because she pays no attention whatsoever to pop culture, to anything, but she just likes Gwyneth, and she bought Gwyneth's cookbook, and I'm like, we're going to have to hide that when people come over because everybody hates her, and she just couldn't understand why, and she's like, why? And I tried to tell her, and everything I said just sounded dumb because the cookbook is really good.
It is.
Yeah. And like, she does look great, and of course it's all about the genetic lottery and being rich. And of course, it's, you know, an incredible reflection of privilege. All those things are true. But underlying all of this resentment, I think, is just that she's the woman who does everything more beautifully than you do. You know, this woman has been around forever. this type of woman, and Gwyneth just happens to be the current one. I mean, one of the things that was also in the news after her announcement came out was about how Graydon Carter wrote a 1,500-word piece about how Vanity Fair had killed a profile of Gwyneth, because mostly it seemed Gwyneth acted out. She got all her friends to say they wouldn't cooperate with Vanity Fair. She, you know, called him up and gave him a hard time. She managed to get a potentially negative profile spiked. She can get things done. That's not necessarily a good thing, but I don't think we should hate her because she is able to do things that the rest of us can't.
Oh, God, that is exactly why I hate her. I'm so annoyed. This is like I'm jealous of Gwyneth and I just want to be her. And that's
exactly.
I hate her so much. It's like that killing of that profile is precisely the reason I can't stand what she represents in the world, because it's inauthentic. It's just, to me, it just reads like a pack of lies, you know, this conscious uncoupling. It's an evasion of the truth in a way that a lot of this language is an evasion of the truth. You know, it makes people feel bad if their divorce includes rancor, which is a completely common human emotion, or just, you know, just a kind of horrible depression because your marriage of X years has broken up or your family's broken up. To me, that's a much more natural progression than where she places the natural progression, which is like biology, lifespan. This is just a natural thing. And here we are in the grass. You know, that's not the way the human condition is meant to be experienced. Like, if you want to know what divorce should be, you should like read the Bible. That seems even more real to me. Like, read the old... read the Torah and be like, oh, that's how it is. Like, you hate each other and you want to kill each other.
You just want more smiting, Hannah.
Yes, exactly. And then you feel like that's life. That's how it gets reflected for me, you know? I'm not like a big gloss person. Like, she and Martha Stewart don't, like, it doesn't do it for
me. Well, that's kind of the fun of watching Gwyneth, I think, is because I don't for a second believe that there wasn't rancor. And I don't for a second believe half the stuff in Goop, like the book she's read, she actually read. I just, like, it's kind of just an amazing, she's like an art project or
right,
something.
Right, exactly.
I don't know. But can I just say my favorite thing from the Graydon Carter letter that he wrote to explain why he'd killed this piece, which is that she called him up and said, you know, what can I do to get people to like me more? And he said, gain 15 pounds, it's worked for me. And she goes, you've gained more than that, which is just... like perfect and awful, like just like straight up mean girl shit. Hannah, if you are interested in the genre of Gwyneth hating, there's a great New York Magazine article from the 90s in which the writer, I can't remember who the writer was, but we'll put it up on the show page. She went to Dalton or Brearley or one of the very fancy the Upper East Side girls' schools. And this was when had very recently become famous and was dating Brad Pitt. And the writer went back and interviewed her high school classmates who were like, oh, yeah, Gwyneth was always like this. She was... And these were like, you know, privileged Upper East Side girls who were like, Gwyneth always had it going for her and it's not fair. And now she's dating Brad Pitt and I can't believe it. It's just kind of delightful. And so she's been inspiring this in other women for years and years and years.
See, I think here's the secret. I'm going to share the secret of life. Look, everybody knows, I know, that it's all fake, that she's just better at faking it than anyone else, and that she can get away with keeping up appearances more than everyone else. But you know what? If you don't read Goop, it's not compulsory. Like, it doesn't actually get fed into your ear or your eyeballs once a week. You know, I feel better about Gwyneth because I just choose to ignore her, except just to, you know, partake from time to time when she does something really outrageous. But we know people like this. She's just, it's just writ large in Gwyneth's case.
Well, and it's like reading Goop is like reading a women's magazine, kind of, except it's just her. I think Graydon Carter made also this point in his letter. It's just her. So it's easier to be like, well, you know, it's not anonymous editors. Yeah. But that's actually part of the fun of reading it for me. Like, you can be like, oh man, like, she's so ridiculous. It's not, you know, some anonymous team of editors hiding behind, you know, advertorial or whatever. Because I don't know. I don't read women's magazines entirely sincerely.
But I also think that is a very attitude of the moment, is to, like you were saying, is to hate something and love something for 15 years at the same time. Like, to be ironic and non-ironic is an attitude a lot of people have about a lot of different things, about TV shows, about fashion trends. That's just a kind of ambivalence of the moment. So maybe Gwyneth perfectly encapsulates that way. She's the perfect target for that modern way of feeling.
She's like the Martha Stewart. Didn't people feel exactly the same way about Martha Stewart. And now yes. Martha Stewart has sort of, I unironically love Martha Stewart, and I can talk about that for hours, but she's sort of like deepened into this like, don't give a fuck, I am who I am person, which Gwyneth kind of has, or she pretends to have, but there's a layer on there. I don't know. They're related. It's like blonde princesses who are doing things better than you are.
So let's just end it like this by saying that what's going to happen is that she and Chris Martin are going to be caught fighting in public in some restaurant. And then she's going to do some horrible thing that's going to get her sent to jail.
Oh.
Right? Like to Chris
Whoa.
Martin. She's going to burn down his half of the home that they both share.
Is this Gwyneth Paltrow fanfic? Is this where we're going?
No. Yes. This is what's going to happen. And then like Martha Stewart, then she'll end up being unironically loved. Like she'll get a tattoo or something. And then she'll, you know, get really tough. And then we'll be able to just un-self-conscious.
You're so wrong, Hannah. She and Chris are going to remarry. They're going to renew their vows. They're going to have two more children. And it's just going to end happily because they're better than the rest of us.
No, they're going to have this home together for like a year. They're going to, one of them's going to quietly move out. And then in like 2 years, they're each going to be dating other very pretty people. And hopefully the kids will be fine.
Okay, we'll bet. We all have a bet. We'll check in on Gwyneth in 5 years on this podcast. All right, enough Gwyneth. On to topic three. The world of celebrity chefs remains a decidedly macho place where bad behavior is tolerated, maybe even required. Yelling, cursing, throwing things at the sous chefs. This weekend, the New York Times Magazine profiled two women who have made it in this world, Barbara Lynch and her protege, Kristen Kish, who are just as accomplished but not necessarily interested in becoming a brand like the men are. The story was actually about female stereotypes, about how women have lost control of the kitchen, and about the difference between male and female styles of mentorship. I'm going to lay my hand out here. I will say that this was one of the rare stories, not rare, but one of those stories that when I got to the end of it, I thought, I am so glad to be female.
Yeah.
Really, I felt like women do shit right. Like these bunch of assholes, like you have these women, you know, who just like they're incredibly successful. They care about all the right things. They treat each other correctly and just like fuck lean in. What this story contrasts basically is Barbara Lynch's relationship with celebrity chef Todd English. She worked in his kitchen. She was his protege. And he was just terrible to her the way, you know, the way that celebrity male chefs are supposed to be. Like when she told him she was leaving, he threw a Coke bottle at her. You know, he dumped pasta on her head because why? I forgot. Like she got she got something in the sauce and then he dumped the whole thing on her head. You know, it's like they're constantly living in a reality show. Like, I don't know if you've read the Anthony Bourdain book, which I read many, many years ago. That was the first book where like every third word is fuck. You know, you're just supposed to be like more macho than macho. And then it kind of, not explicitly, but it moves into Barbara Lynch becoming herself very successful, although locally successful in Boston. She doesn't seem at all interested in kind of making herself one of these huge brands. And under her wing comes another chef, Kristen Kish. And she encourages Kristen Kish in the most lovely way to go on to Top Chef. You know, and Kristen Kish is uncomfortable. She's like, oh, they're just going to talk about how pretty I am. And Barbara Lynch basically says, great, you are pretty. Use it. This is a time in your life. You're a great chef. You should use this to further your career. And she pushes her forward. And then they just have this like wonderful mentoring relationship. And then, you know, it ends with Kristen Kish leaving Barbara Lynch. And she really doesn't throw a Coke bottle in her head. They have like a just kind of wonderful, you know, goodbye party and union at the end. And it just makes you proud to be female, the whole thing.
It did. I mean, at the same time, there's something about that environment. You think if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. I mean, I would much rather work for Barbara Lynch or April Bloomfield or a woman. But then again, my personality would just so not suit the kitchen anyway. I mean, it does sound like it's like working on a coal face, you know, that it is very macho and sweary and it's very high pressure and the hours are horrible. And it's kind of a gross job. And so it selects for people who are just so dedicated and kind of crazy and maybe drink a lot and do drugs. I mean, it's a very selective environment. And I agree totally that was the takeaway, that women do it better. But at the same time, it's also this thing of like, but you know what? I wouldn't want anything to do with it either way.
I mean, Lynch was kind of an interesting character because she came from a very hardscrabble life. You know, there's like a lot of drugs. One of her sisters a heroin addict. Like you could see why she could tough it out in those kitchens.
Yeah.
You know, She wasn't coming from like the Culinary Institute of America. Like, she's basically kind of uneducated in cooking and just is a kind of tough
person.
Well,
and that's kind of the old school of cooking, right? I mean, it isn't till fairly recently, I think, that cooking was quite such a prestige career, or like, you know, people talk about it as being like the rock stars of our era or whatever. Right. But it was more often people, I think, from a working class background. This was an avenue that was more open to them, as opposed to sort of like you go to college and then you go to culinary school and then you, you know, embark upon this shining career.
Yeah, I mean, it does have this reputation as being a meritocracy, that it's not where you went to school. It's not, you know, you don't have to be an Ivy Leaguer. In fact, the thing to do is to be hard, to work hard, mm-hmm. to have talent, to get things right, and just to be a beast.
You guys are right that we've forgotten about this element of it. We're so used to cooking being a kind of high-end Brooklyn operation, you know, that we've forgotten that there are these like sweatshop kitchens out there, and that's the old model of how you become a great chef.
Yeah, I recently spoke to the author of a book that I mentioned on a recent podcast for Today I'm a Boy, which is a novel about a trans woman, or a guy who's in transition, I guess you should say. And a lot of the action takes place in kitchens. And so I asked the writer, Kim Fu, why she'd chosen that. And she said that she had worked in professional kitchens. And as a cisgender woman who was also had kind of issues about gender and never really felt quite comfortable playing at being a woman and just kind of the performance of it, she loved the kitchen because it was such an exaggerated place that, like, all chefs, no matter what their gender is, are guys, and they have to act like old-fashioned guys. And the wait staff or the kind of the crew that's serving them, they're all women, no matter what their gender. They are the girls, and they're, you know, and the chefs are the guy. And it's just, and she kind of liked that because it was so exaggerated and so much about performance. And I do see the attraction of that. Like, it's not about you. It's not about what you want. It's just about playing a role. And that is kind of appealing. It's like you don't really have to, you know, express yourself. You just have to, like, get stuff done.
So do you think the Barbara Lynch kitchen sounds boring by comparison? Like, this is an interesting take, because are we losing something by losing the macho chef? That the macho chef is not necessarily gender specific, but that it's just, you know, comes with the job description. And so instead of being how Barbara Lynch is, which is fairly humble, local, you know, quietly determined, we should celebrate the celebrity chef as the kind of last bastion of bad behavior in a country which is becoming increasingly intolerant of bad behavior, and just say, like, women can be that way.
Well, we don't know that she's not macho in the kitchen. Right. I mean, she, like, she cooks meat. You can be a good person and be sort of like macho. You don't have to be swaggery. Like, I suspect that she's tougher than, you know, than worse. I just don't picture her as sort of a gentle soul.
Right. I mean, and there was actually a nice example. I mean, the writer, whose name I don't remember, you know, did take the time to show sort of a correction in this piece by Kish or Lynch. I don't remember which one it was. Because, kitchens at this level really do have to be hard places. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's both a lot of the time they're either self-employed and therefore, you know, have to maintain quality to, you know, pay their bills, or they're, you know, but the chef is the person who's responsible. At the same time, it's team. So it's just like working in an office and, you know, getting your support staff to all, you know, work hard and do the right thing. You do have to get people to behave properly. Now, I don't believe that throwing bottles and yelling and throwing at things is really that effective, even if that has been the way that it's been done for many years. So I wish I had a better sense of how these women do it. I would love to know, like, April Bloomfield seems like a very interesting person to me. Why is she different? She's got three, you know, one of the things that was very interesting too in this piece was the lack of head chefs who were women. They had some numbers like 12% of James Beard's outstanding chef winners are women, 16% of Food and Wine's best new chefs women. I mean, most of the top chefs are guys, and why?
Well, the hours. I forget which sort of famous chef was quoted in here. Maybe Jean Georges. I forget. Anyway, but he said women just seem to want to need more of a life. Yeah. He wasn't even saying women want to have children, but he was like, you know, women just, they don't want to live their lives in this sweaty kitchen where everyone's like doing drugs and staying up till you know, sun break, and they want, you know, to sit somewhere outside, maybe, which I thought was kind of, I mean, I bet people will get angry about that and call it sexism or whatever, but I thought it was kind of nice. It was like, women are reasonable and they want to be balanced human beings more often than men do.
It was interesting.
Yeah, this is a very women are reasonable story. The other thing I liked about this more broadly is, you know, we have ceded the kitchen as the province for to men. I've written about this before without really knowing it was happening. The rise of foodie culture has basically, you know, turned food into kind of a, you know, a garage operation, like tinkering and, you know, perfectionism, and just kind of men are really into it now. So I like these stories that kind of shifted back into being a feminine space. Like, we got rid of it because it was sexist that they were enslaving us and keeping us in the kitchen, but we kind of let go of it too quickly, in my opinion, and it became a male bastion. And so it's nice to see some women
The kitchen is an interesting thing here because the article also makes the point that on television, which is sort of where that's how we consume food culture now, as we watch the Food Channel, you know, the celebrity chefs on television are sort of restaurant guys with like big personalities and they're like things. And even if they're different, you know, Tom Colicchio is very nice versus, you know, whatever other chef is sort of more of a bad boy. The women tend to be nice ladies who are showing you how to cook for your family, not how to make like a super impressive, crazy meal. They're like, it's like Rachel Ray whipping up something nice, or it's, you know, the Barefoot Contessa who's whipping up something cholesterol filled. It's it's just a very different vibe, and that's just what sells on TV. So that has very little to do with the content of their food and more to do with the image that they are projecting. And so we do still want women in the kitchen, but it's a specific kind of kitchen, and it's got like a, you know, a French country look to it and a nice backsplash, and it is not sort of an industrial strength kitchen.
Although there is another aspect to this, which was that there's another potential role, which is the lesbian chef. I mean, it is striking how many of the female chefs that we see on the Food Network are lesbians. And this piece outed Kristen Kish, and kind of I was a little confused as to whether it also outed Barbara Lynch, who has been married and has a child, as maybe having a girl. They used the term girlfriend, and I couldn't tell what kind of girlfriend that was. So there's also this, you know, another part of the kind of bad boy, edgy kitchen culture also seems to attract a certain number of lesbians.
My favorite, I think I've recommended this on the podcast before, but one of my favorite food books ever is Blood, Bones, and Butter by Gabrielle Hamilton, who was a lesbian and then married and had a kid with a man, I believe. But that whole journey is in there, and just all the, you know, it's a great book if you want to read about women in the kitchen.
I will say that this I'm jealous of. Like, Goop does nothing for me and Gwyneth does nothing for me, but these guys, like that, I want to be them. Okay, well, since you started on the recommendations, Noreen, let's move on to our recommendations. Why don't you go first?
This is an old book that I have been reading, and it's just so good that I can't not recommend it. You guys have probably already read it. Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc is just an amazing piece of reporting. She follows a group of people in the Bronx for years upon years upon years. They're very poor, and she sort of shows how poverty, you know, holds people back, but it is not boring. That sounds like a sociology book. It is like the most amazing soap opera
It's like a soap opera. You can't believe it. Like, it's so depressing when you think about how they keep getting dragged back and dragged back. The book is unbelievable. But, like, you know, every time they try something, they get dragged back. But the drama in the life of a poor person, you know, it's like you said, it's like a weird thing it's a weird way to put it. But it's true. You know, you think, really, you spend a decade, you know, hanging out with this one poor family. But the book is just gripping. It's really amazing. My recommendation is also an article that appeared in The New Yorker this summer but came back up to me because it was nominated for a National Magazine Award, which is Sarah Stillman's article in The New Yorker called Taken, about civil forfeiture. It's an unbelievable story about how local governments use these laws called civil forfeiture laws to basically take people's properties away, and how they've come to depend on the revenue from these properties of poor people. It was a law intended to kind of nab drug dealers, but it's now used against very poor people, and local police departments depend on this revenue in order to keep themselves going. And it's really an amazing story. So I just want to bring back attention to that. June.
So I am going to break with form and recommend something new, a book that came out earlier this year. And it is very much a kind of a work in progress. I'm about two-thirds of the way through, but I'm also very aware that I'm reading the first book in what will be a four-part series, which is a feeling that I often have, like when you're watching the pilot of a TV show. You can kind of see how they're setting things up and you don't really know how it's going to work out. So this is a book called Changers Book One, Drew, and it's by T. Cooper and Alison Glock Cooper, who are a married couple. It's about this, bear with me, race of beings who change four times. Each year of high school, they take on a different body. And it's relevant, I think, that T. Cooper is a trans man, and so he's maybe more aware of identity and kind of presentation and just how your gender changes so much. So with all those provisos that I've just mentioned about, well, it's the first in a series and it's setting things up, it's really interesting. And it's meant for kids, I think, for young adults, which I also find quite appealing. And I love American high school books. It's set in high school and it's super interesting. And it's called Changers, Book One, Drew.
You know, the Gretchen Rubin Happiness Project book, it somehow made its way to be sitting in my bathroom, you know, so I'm rereading bits of it part of a time. And I was just reading this morning that section where she says she's just going to do what makes her happy and, like, not care what, you know, that often you do things you think will make you happy or that make other people happy. And it turns out the thing that makes her happy is reading YA books. Like, she just decided to give into that and, like, you know, read a lot of sort of children's and young adult books. Once again, listeners, please send us an email at XXGabFest@Slate.com with responses to our podcast. We would like to thank Chris Wade for recording the podcast. June Thomas is going to engineer the podcast this week. Thank you, June. As always, we thank Andy Bowers, who is on vacation this week, but who is the executive producer of all of the Slate podcasts. It's been lovely talking with you, and we will be with you again in a couple of weeks.